So the session you're in is Coppering Bets Against Climate Change, Facing Uncertainty in Agricultural and Forest Systems. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the phrase, copy your bets. Maybe if you're a poker player, you are. I actually, when I was trying to figure out a snappy little title for this program, I looked up old Western slang and found this phrase. I'm not a poker player. I don't know anything about coppering your bets. But what it means, essentially, it comes from when people would take a penny that, of course, was once upon a time actually made fully of copper and put it on a chip. And it's essentially betting against or betting that someone else is going to lose. So the phrase has come to mean betting against loss. And, of course, in agricultural and forest systems and in ranching, too, in the American West, there is a lot of loss that we're looking at and a lot of money to be made in loss in terms of how this is addressed. So today, to talk a little bit about this, we have three panelists I'm really excited to present to you. We'll start right here on my right. This is Dr. Wayne Polly. He's a research ecologist at the Grassland Soil and Water Research Lab, which is part of the USDA's Agriculture Research Service, and he's based in Temple, Texas. Dr. Polly has a PhD in rangeland science from Colorado State University, and his research looks at trying to clarify the effects of global changes, including atmospheric CO2 enrichment, and altered precipitation patterns on the ecological processes that govern rangeland ecosystems. And then to his right is Brandon Loomis, who's the public lands reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You may have seen Brandon's series in 2011, Our Dying Forests, about the loss of the really unprecedented loss of conifer forest in the American West. And I should note that he won the Grantham Prize this past year. He has the distinction of being the last Grantham Prize winner since the Grantham Prize is no more.
We all are,
but that's another session entirely. Nonetheless, Brandon and the team that he worked with there did a really, really phenomenal job of covering all of these effects of climate and poor management on forests, and I highly recommend it. And then to Brandon's right is Chris Clayton, who is the agriculture policy editor for DTN, The Progressive Farmer. He's also incoming president of the North American Agricultural Journalists.
Current.
Oh, that was a little taken.
A while ago.
Okay. Current president, then, North American Agricultural Journalists. He has been working at DTN since 2005. Prior to that, he worked for the Omaha World Herald. And he's been covering agricultural issues for quite a long time, also a very well-awarded man himself for the various kinds of coverage he's done. So we obviously do not have a way to present these slides at this point, but I wanted to start off by, again, talking about uncertainty and setting the conversation up to talk about the kinds of changes that have been observed in these agricultural and forest and rangeland systems. And the temporal and spatial scale of some of these changes. And then, of course, what are the big questions that are trying to be figured out at this point? Holy cow. Oh, we're going to project something for you now.
Bring the big one.
Yeah, no kidding. So, while that's...
Computer's being towed.
All right, we're getting closer all the time to this. So I'd like to start off with Chris. And Chris, we'll follow up with your slides in just a second, and I'll advance them for you since I have this here. But I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the kinds of changes that have been observed in the agricultural sector in terms of climate change-related change, and what has this meant to the farmers and other folks in the ag sector?
Thank you, Sunshine. The difficult thing about it with
agriculture and climate change in terms of policy area, which is where I do most of my work, is that we've really ignored it. It's more or less kind of like the elephant in the room, so to speak. We're just not really talking about it on a policy level in Washington, particularly when it comes to issues in Congress, like anything else. So it's odd, given what's been going on with our weather systems and such, that we aren't talking about it, but that is the case at the moment. Ag is constantly more or less in this tug and pull between production and conservation. And when you have yields going down or production goes down for any given reason, you see a sudden push or a sudden desire to increase production. You see that in some of the changes we're seeing in the Farm Bill. We're going to cut about 5 million acres out of the Conservation Reserve Program, primarily to put more land into production in one form or another. That is really kind of one of these shifts, partially because we're seeing some numbers stagnate and we're seeing more demand increase on agricultural commodities. So I could go over the spiel about 9 billion people and all of the food we have to produce in the next 25, 50 years, but you've heard a great deal of that in the past couple of days as well. So I wouldn't focus too much on that. But, you know, if you look at climate models, what you see is that drought potentially becomes the new normal. When you look at the IPCC numbers, they call them the representative concentration pathways, these wonderful governmental terms that they use. Even if we're lowering emissions over the next 40 or 50 years, we're going to see the 2 to 3 Celsius increase in temperature. If we don't have any changes, we're going to see a 3 to 5.5% increase. Hey, there we go. That's a wonderful deal there. Please. There's my wonderful elephant I started talking about. One of the reasons I had this Dust Bowl picture in here is simply because I think this is one of the reasons it's difficult to get people in rural America to believe that there's something different happening in the climate, because the stories of their fathers and their grandparents about the Dust Bowl, and as bad as it is to quote the worst hard times, I think this is one of the reasons that it makes it very difficult to make the case in rural America that something different is happening out there when it comes to our weather and climate. And that's why I kind of included that picture in there. And this was actually taken, you know, this was taken a year ago here in Lubbock, Texas. So this just more or less reflects that, you know, we're seeing these dust storms starting to come back in some sense. I don't know if you saw yesterday, obviously in Oklahoma, they had a dust storm, had a 30-car pileup on I-35. They shut down Interstate 35 because of a dust storm in Oklahoma. And these are your models I was just talking about. This right here is with lesser emissions, and this is the model showing what happens in the second half of the century with more emissions. And you can see basically the notion that drought becomes the new normal. Some climate scientists I was speaking with at the University of Nebraska were talking that in Nebraska, under the darker scenario over there on the right-hand side, that the percentage of months that we would have drought in the second half of the century increases 45 to 85%. So that's the number of months that we're like in a drought situation, literally increases somewhere at 45 to 85%. That's a lot of shift in drought. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with Don Wubles from the University of Illinois. He's a climate scientist there. He had warned that climate in Illinois over this last half of the century would begin to look like East Texas. The University of Nebraska did similar work and talking about similar shifts. Well, if you look at North Platte, Nebraska, basically about right here, 600 miles due north from Lubbock, Texas. If you take the climate models and suggestions there, then North Platte, Nebraska ends up having the climate and the weather temperature ranges that we see in North Platte, or that we see in Lubbock now. That's the kind of shift that you're going to see. Now that translates into also, though, in parts of the country, longer growing seasons. We may be able to plant crops much earlier in states such as Nebraska and Kansas than we are able to now. We may also able to get potentially double cropping in areas that we don't have now. However, that increased temperature also translates into higher moisture level needs for the crops as well. We irrigate intensively in Nebraska, for instance. We're probably the biggest irrigation state in the country. All the center pivots you saw on your trips in Texas here, all those companies are based in Nebraska. All that work, all those center pivot companies are based and started in Nebraska. So that's where that technology came from. Take a quick, and then we'll go to the next slide. I'm sorry. This is just basically as I was discussing here, what we're seeing with higher emissions and the temperature shifts that we're going to begin to see in the latter 20, 30 years of the century. And go ahead, I'm already way ahead of this. So, drought costs. This is what I focus on more in more policy realm is what are the costs that we see when it comes to some of our various disasters. Hurricanes, when you have a year like a big hurricane like Katrina, obviously the cost of a disaster like that will blow away a drought. But most of the years we see some of the biggest impacts you have in terms of biggest disasters in the country are droughts. This year, we're looking at probably at least $20 billion in crop insurance payments alone because of the high commodity cost that we already had going into this year and the level of crop destruction that we've had. In Texas, you've had droughts really going back just in the last 18 years. And what we've seen in Texas is a 3 million head decline in the cattle herd going back to 1996. They had a drought in 1996. That year alone, they lost about 1 million head of cattle. They've been in a slow decline ever since. Other factors obviously play into that, whether it's somebody people retiring, whether it's land being taken out of use because of urban sprawl, other factors. But drought has been the main thing. Every year you see a major drought, you see Texas cattle numbers drop dramatically, and they don't recover back to the level they were before. So, again, since 1996, 3 million head of cattle. You're talking basically that's also 3 million calves that don't come. So it affects the food supply in that realm. And then go ahead, Sanchez. This is just we talk about what are agriculture's major environmental challenges. Soil erosion is probably the biggest agricultural environmental challenge that continues. What's the value of something like conservation compliance? Most farmers right now of any size rely a lot more on their crop insurance than they rely on any other federal subsidy. The farm bill has been a push by environmental groups to have conservation compliance, minimum standards for protecting from soil erosion tied to crop insurance. The farm groups have resisted this in this farm bill. They don't want to see that occur. They want to have the crop insurance, but they do not want to tie any minimum conservation standards to that. So if I'm a very large farmer, and the new subsidy system is only going to pay me a maximum of potential of $50,000 in any given year, but I can get $1 million in my crop insurance, why would I really have to be too concerned about applying minimum conservation standards to my ground if I can plow right on up through to the end of my fields? Nutrient runoff, another major problem, obviously. We're going to see continuing regulatory pressures on agriculture because of water quality, nitrogen and phosphorus in the system. The lawsuits and litigation over the hypoxia zone are continuing to try to put pressure on states to have more regulatory standards on agricultural runoff. And then one more, next slide, Sunshine. This is just some discussion when we talk about, I hate the term sustainable anymore. I'm just basically sick of hearing it, because sustainable right now basically is whatever you want it to be. And we're all sustainable. And if what you see with so many groups, so many companies and everybody else is they just decide, if they don't like what somebody else calls sustainable, they go start another group and they find the people in there that works with them and they classify themselves sustainable. And if you're part of that group and you don't work well with them, you go find another group and you call yourself sustainable. I did a piece back in April about ag sustainability, and I found at least five different groups, and each one of them didn't like what somebody other group was doing to classify, quote, what was sustainable. So they created their own separate group. So, you know, when everybody right now within the next couple of years will be putting out press releases saying they did a study and found out, by God, they're sustainable. So... but this is what are you trying to protect? Are you trying to protect the water in the aquifer? Are you trying to protect the production level that you have to continue to produce? Are you trying to increase production to feed the world? Right now, like I said, I think it's a marketing effort. And I guess next slide on that. As I said, the 2012 Farm Bill, we don't really touch upon... we don't touch upon climate change or adaptation. We ignore the topic, which actually is beneficial in that the USDA is allowed to continue the programs that they have. That will depend somewhat also on any change in administration we might see. The USDA has been doing quite a bit. They just rolled out these agroecology ARS locations around the country, 10 of them so far, to focus on improving soil health, focus on improving water quality. That is an ARS initiative and a science research initiative. At the National Natural Resources Conservation Services, the Soil Service, they are now focusing on a new soil health initiative, no-till production and putting in cover crops. And then we have a lot of studies right now by NEFA on climate projects. Actually, the Soil Society meets starting Sunday in Cincinnati, which is where I go when I leave here. And the NEFA groups are supposed to roll out and kind of lay out where they are at in their projects studying the impacts of climate change on some various crop production. So I'm kind of looking forward to see where they're at in that process.
Chris, I want to move on to
sure.
Come back to these questions about policy.
Okay.
So, Wayne, if you could give us now a quick summary of the work that you're doing at the Grassland and Soils Research Center.
Okay. Let me go to the next slide, please. Let me just begin by saying that our work has been focused on what we call direct effects of rising atmospheric carbon dioxide and CO2 concentrations. And we're studying grasslands or shrublands, what we call rangelands, generally extensively managed systems that cover most of the western U.S. and use primarily for grazing activities, livestock production. Just to reinforce a point that Chris has made, climate change, as I understand the models and the predictions, of course, call for a warmer climate. A warmer climate in general means a speeding up of the hydrological cycle and will, in general, result in increased rainfall. And in some areas, the rainfall will be reduced, and the models suggest that that will be the case in the southern plains and southwestern U.S., the areas that we're most interested in studying. So with that as background, I want to talk about the direct effects of CO2. Carbon dioxide, of course, is a greenhouse gas. As I've illustrated here, and as you probably know, atmospheric CO2 concentration has increased about 40% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So we've gone from 270 parts per million, CO2 is measured in parts per million volume in the atmosphere, to now 385 or so, and of course that concentration is projected to at least reach double the pre-industrial concentration by mid-century. Next, I have a little simple cartoon. Well, we skipped the cartoon. There's the cartoon. Just to illustrate the role of CO2 in plant growth and plant productivity. So there are two reasons we're interested in CO2, and that's either the slide we skipped or the next slide. One that you hear most about, and it's been talked about extensively, is the role of CO2 as a greenhouse gas, contributing to warming by reducing the emission of thermal radiation to space that normally cools the planet. So on average, incoming radiation is balanced by the energy and outgoing radiation, and the temperature remains about constant. CO2 is a greenhouse gas. One of the greenhouse gases short circuits that. That's what we know as the greenhouse effect, and that's what the consequences of which Chris just described. But CO2 also has a direct effect, and it's usually a positive effect on plant productivity. It is not very well publicized, and I don't know if you've encountered this very much in your researches in your reporting. Basically, CO2 is a fertilizer for plants because about 40% of the dry weight of plants is carbon. It's derived entirely from CO2 in the atmosphere. It diffuses into the leaves where it's fixed in the process of photosynthesis. Is this too basic? Everybody know about this? Or is still interested in listening? Keep going? Okay. So you can appreciate then is that CO2 concentration increases in the atmosphere. CO2 would be a fertilizer, and plants in general would grow bigger or faster. An unavoidable consequence of CO2 uptake, because it has to come through these small pores on plant leaves, is water loss. One of the benefits of CO2 is particularly important in the drier areas in which we're interested, is that CO2 reduces that stomatal pore size generally, which reduces water loss without greatly restricting CO2 uptake. This is what we call an increase in water use efficiency, meaning plants can grow more on the same amount of water. Really important positive effect of CO2 enrichment on plant productivity, particularly in drier areas. Next picture, please. So I want to talk just very briefly about a study that we're involved in now, the main focus of which is to look at how changes in CO2 through the past and into the future would increase what we call plant productivity. And that's nothing more than the amount that plants grow in a given period of time. Typically, we think over a growing season or annual cycle. The reason I put this slide in, we've just talked about how CO2 affects productivity, but I want to try to communicate that the CO2 effect varies in different places and at different times, and it does so because other of the regulators of productivity listed there differ from place to place. So the CO2 effect depends on soil type, for example, fertility, water holding capacity. Different plants respond differently to CO2. CO2 effect on plant productivity depends on how much it rains, how warm or cold it is, disturbance regimes like grazing and fire. Next, please. So we're using a truly unique facility to study how the pre-industrial to present and present to projected increase in CO2 is impacting these processes. And the interaction from the previous slide that we're studying in particular is the interaction between, or the mediating effect of soil type on grassland response to CO2. So this is our experimental system. It's a closed system over which we maintain a continuous gradient in CO2 that goes from the pre-industrial concentration to mid-21st century concentration. We have represented along that system vegetation growing on three different soil types. Next, please. This is just a picture to show you the open system at the end of the season. Next. And then this is how we measure productivity. Pretty glamorous operation here. You go out and you hand clip the vegetation. We separate it by species, put it in a paper bag, dry it, and weigh it. So that everything is produced above that clip line in a given year is what we call productivity. It's how much the plants grew in this given year. And you can appreciate that more productivity generally is a good thing if you're raising cattle or you're harvesting material for biofuel production, for example. Next. So this is just to give you a taste for some of the data, how the three different soil types we have represented from sandy to silty clay to clay affect the response of productivity above ground biomass on the y-axis to our CO2 gradient. The couple of things I want to point out is one, obviously there's a pretty dramatic increase in the amount of plant growth in our experiment here on all soils from the pre-industrial elevated concentration. And then second, you clearly see there's a different response curve. Curvilinear reaching or approaching saturation perhaps on the clay and silty clay soils, linear on the sandy soil. Next. And there are a couple of reasons that is, but one of the reasons is that if you look at the top where we represented the CO2 effect on productivity for the sandy soil, you'll see there's also a positive CO2 effect that's linked through soil water. The water is soil water content. And that's because CO2, as we talked before, closes those stomates on the pores on the leaves, reduces water loss, water content in the soil remains higher longer during droughts, and at least on this soil, there's a positive feedback so that when droughts come, the plants continue growing longer in the drought as a result of a CO2 increase in soil water content mediated through plant water use. So I think that's it. I guess my general point to you is that like you consider, if you haven't already, there is another side to this story of CO2 enrichment, and that is a generally positive effect of CO2 enrichment on plant growth. Now, like any change, there are positive and negatives associated with this. Some of the downsides, one of the downsides is that CO2 enrichment typically reduces forage quality by reducing crude protein content, so that is a negative if you're a rancher or you're a cow. CO2 enrichment may favor weedy plants over your preferred forage plants. That's another potential negative. But just that there's this other side to the story. And in some cases, in one case, in an experiment in Wyoming, the positive effects of doubling CO2 concentration offset the negative effects of warming in their system over at least a period of a few years.
You cut for all plant types, or just grasses, increases biomass for the forage ability?
Yes, generally. So some species respond more, some respond less, but in general terms.
So everything is working.
Yes.
All right, so Brandon, can you now give us an update on what kinds of changes you've seen in western forests and how these are related to climate change?
Yeah, so if you live in a mountain or forest environment of the western U.S. like I do, you will have noticed over the last decade or so significant death of the trees turning red. These are the conifers turning red, then turning gray. And it's the result of a native beetle species or several native beetle species that coexist with these trees and burrow into them and overwhelm them and choke them off and lay their eggs in there to reemerge the next year and attack new trees. It's interesting that, Chris, you mentioned the Dust Bowl, the worst hard times. I also found a lot of people comparing what's happening now to the Dust Bowl and not favorably, that it's much worse this time around than it was when the climate favored beetles before. I heard foresters and entomologists using phrases like 10 times worse. It's hard to quantify it. I never was able to do that very well, because in those days, people who were measuring how much tree loss there was were on basically riding mules up into the mountains and looking out, and now it's done much more sophisticated manner with aerial photography and GPS and whatnot. But the extent of the loss of forest, of mature forest in the West, is 40 million acres since about 1997, which is, I think, there's about twice that left that the Forest Service classifies as, you know, mature, older trees that are sort of primed for more of the same if you don't do something about it. And there's 40 million or more also in Western Canada that have been affected. So, you know, as I said, it's a native species, and so it's not all climate. You can't blame everything on the climate. There were factors going back to the 19th century that sort of set us up for this with our use of the forests. Settlers at that time in the West, miners, railroad builders, cut big swaths of trees at that time, kind of around the same time, and what grew back and has been left to grow since then has become older and susceptible to beetles, kind of all at once. Then around World War II, firefighting methods became much more efficient, using aircraft and whatnot, and smoke jumpers, and you had very effective fire control, taking out this natural system that in the past would have created more of a mosaic of age classes. So now you have basically the whole West primed for something to happen, and if it's not going to be fire, if you're not going to let it be fire, then the beetle starts to work on it, and the beetle explodes to levels that you don't normally see. You might see every generation or so some kind of explosion, but nothing like this. And then from there, the climate change comes in, where since 1970 or so, many of these valleys and mountain ranges that I'm talking about in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, have warmed by 4 to 6 degrees on average over the course of the year. And similarly, the winter averages have warmed, which is an important point, because the beetles, typically in the past, if you had really cold snaps, 40 below, that lasted for a few days, it would kill the beetles, or at least kill many of them, and you wouldn't have this kind of explosive growth. And now you don't have those very often. So the warming temperatures does two things. It stresses the trees, because you have a warmer, drier environment for a longer period in the summer, a longer growing season without, in many places, the moisture that you would need to help these trees actually grow well during that time. So they're stressed to begin with, and then the warmth also aids the beetles. Throughout the summer, the attack happens in July, and then for the rest of the summer the larvae are developing and preparing for winter, and they have to reach a certain point in their development to be able to survive the winter. They're able to do this quicker in warmer temperatures, and they're also this leads to, in many places, a cycle where they're able to attack the next year, they're ready, rather than it taking 2 years, which is what it would have done in many of the colder places in the West in the past. So all this leads to exponential growth in the population. The warming also helps to open up new territory to the beetles, such as in the Yellowstone ecosystem, where I spent some time writing about whitebark pine. These are trees that grow at 10,000 feet, areas that beetles often would have had a hard time surviving before, and now they don't. And so these trees, which aren't really used to being attacked, are now being attacked. It also has caused them to, in some cases, jump species of trees to trees that they might not have favored in the past, such as where the lodgepole pine has been wiped out. If you're familiar with Colorado, that's basically what's happened there, is lodgepole pine forests have been wiped out. In Montana, there's a mix of lodgepole and ponderosa, which is a little more robust, a better fighter against the pine beetle. But all the lodgepole pine is gone in certain areas, so the pine beetle has to find something to attack now. It's into the lodgepole. And it also has led to beetles moving north, where before they wouldn't have been able to survive north of central British Columbia. Now they're getting into, they're right on the edge of the Yukon, the Northwest Territories in Canada, spilling over the Rockies into central Alberta, where they just couldn't survive before. So the result for ecosystems around the West can be pretty significant. In Yellowstone, with the whitebark pine, a lot of people expect it to be functionally extinct, which means it'll still be around in some numbers but not serving its purpose throughout that ecosystem within a decade or so. And it's a significant tree for several reasons, because it's high in the watershed, so it retains snow, allows for kind of more of an orderly release of water through the summer, so you have streams that are cooler and more full later in the summer. It also feeds squirrels and birds and the grizzly bears that follow after them and dig up the seeds. And because the whitebark is collapsing, the federal courts have not allowed the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to delist the grizzly bear in that area, specifically because that tree is declining and they want more science before they'll allow it, even though the grizzly bear has increased its population over the years. I guess the other consequence is for the future. Forests will probably look different. They may have different compositions of tree species. Trees may move their ranges if they can do it quickly enough. I dealt with scientists at the Rocky Mountain Research Station of the U.S. Forest Service. And, for instance, in my state, in Utah, they're looking at the climate models, and probably other people here are more familiar with those models than I am, but they're using the A2 model. So whatever that means to you, you know, take it with a grain of salt. They seem to think that, given what they've seen so far in greenhouse gas releases, that it seemed reasonable, maybe even conservative to them. I don't know. But given that scenario, the foresters up at this research station in Moscow, Idaho, say that by the end of the century, about 90% of the suitable habitat for Engelmann spruce in Utah will be gone, mostly up in the northeast part in the Uinta Mountains, which, you know, this is a tree species that's all over the mountains in Utah, down almost to Arizona, is our most commercially important tree, and it just won't have suitable habitat, according to them, by that time. It doesn't mean there won't be trees there. Some other species will move in and move up the hill, but it'll be a very different looking forest probably in the next century. And I mean, the other thing that I find just astonishing is that, you know, their projections is that you look at the comparison between Salt Lake City and Brighton Ski Resort, which is about, I think it's about 6,000 feet difference, you know, right next to each other, up the canyon to the ski resort. But if there's a 5.5 degree Celsius increase by the end of the century, the growing season at Brighton would basically be the same as Salt Lake City's, very close. It would more than double the number of days where trees need to be trying to grow, frost-free days, basically. So is there going to be the moisture there to support that? The moisture models don't sound very good to me either. So, I mean, something's going to grow there, but it's going to be very different, apparently.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. So I know we've covered a lot of ground here, and this was kind of an ambitious panel for us to take on all these different things. So I want to open it up for questions first. Oh, and sorry, just a reminder of the rules. SCJA members first, and please say who you are and your affiliation.
My name is Bobby McGill. I'm a department reporter from Fort Collins, Colorado. We are seeing bark beetles move down into the ponderosa zone. So if you go to Rocky National Park right now, you'll be greeted first with lots of dead trees on the east side of the park, which is new. The park rangers took me up last July, actually right after the Hyde Park fire, which burned lots of bark beetle kill trees, to some of their high elevation forests. And one of the things they're noticing that they find particularly disturbing is the die-off of limber pines. And these are trees that grow, I think, above 10,000 feet, or 10,000 feet or so, and are being hit by bark beetles. And this is not something that's normal. This is, they project that the limber pine will be completely absent from the park in the not-too-distant future. The other thing we're seeing farther south in Roosevelt National Forest is the sort of near the Mount Evans area, is the die-off of some of our bristlecone pine stands. We don't have a lot of bristlecone pine. It's a different species of bristlecone pine than exists in the Great Basin in Utah. But what I'm wondering, in your research, did you find any, what level of impact did you see on bristlecone pines, particularly in the Great Basin and western Nevada?
Bristlecone I didn't get into much because in the Great Basin it tends to be, you know, down in these island areas,
right.
Mountain ranges, like Great Basin National Park, places like that, where, to my understanding, the beetle hasn't been able to get there, the mountain pine beetle that would be affecting them.
The reason I ask is these are ancient trees.
Yeah.
They're older in your neck of the woods than they are in ours.
Yeah. No, it's, and we do have limber pine above the canyons in Salt Lake City, and they are being hit. These, all three of those trees are related. They're the five-needle pines, and they all grow exceptionally long. The white bark pine grows, you know, I think to 1,200 years. I'm not sure about limber pine, but they're all, I should speak to limber and white bark. Both grow right there at the top, the tree line. They create these microclimates where other trees can grow where they otherwise wouldn't be able to get a foothold. The way they're being hit right now, and do you know Diana Thombeck at University of Colorado Denver?
I do.
I just talked to her, and she was complaining about how she wasn't getting any attention, and not her specifically, but the limber pine in Colorado.
Right.
You know that.
Maybe she didn't read my story.
But I think there's a lot of concern about that, both because these trees live so long, and it takes so long for them to get to where they can produce cones, and they have to be able to make it through whatever is happening right now to the point where they can regenerate at some point.
One of the reasons they pointed out that this is a sign of climate change and not this year's drought, because there are plenty of signs of this year's drought. There are subalpine spruce die-off at timberline, which is very, very distinct. But that's only because we need a lot of snow this year. It's not necessarily a direct cause of, or a direct effect of climate change, they said. But these limber pines have sustained because they're so ancient. I don't know how old they are, several hundred years old at least. They've been able to sustain differences in weather patterns for a very, very long time. And it's taken this particular warming period over the last 10 years to really hit them hard.
Exactly, and there's been no evidence of this kind of hit on those trees in these previous outbreaks that would have been more natural. And there is some question, I hear both sides of this, there's some question among scientists as to whether white bark and limber pine have the kind of natural defenses they need, whether they evolved to have them because the beetles weren't there, you know, whether they don't have toxic enough pitch or whatever it might be. There's work going on that at the University of Wisconsin right now, trying to figure out whether white bark specifically is not as well equipped. I don't think there's a clear answer yet.
Another question?
Hi, I'm Beth Daly from the Boston Globe. I have two questions, but the first one is for Chris. I read a lot about the crop insurance being tied to these soil measures, but I don't really understand the argument and why it failed. Could you sum it up for us?
Tied to?
The minimum soil erosion.
Oh.
Could you explain that?
Well, simply the loss of soil
an erosion factors into the ability to sustain that land long term in terms of producing. It also, the soil erosion is what is going to be causing your nitrogen and phosphorus runoff, and particularly into the in the streams and rivers. Most of the soil, most of the runoff you see coming in is mainly from tilled ground, and you get a heavy rainfall, and it sweeps those nutrients right into your watershed. If you don't have minimum soil standards, and frankly, there's an argument to be made that the USDA shouldn't allow allowable erosion. There should be zero tolerance, is what many people argue should be happening. But by not having an amendment standard on that, basically, if you go by, if you're taking a canoe trip in a stream, and you see somebody's field slumping off into that stream, there would be no real regulatory standard.
I'm curious how the policy fight played out. That's what I was curious about. Like, I know there was a push to get included in for crop insurance. Why did that fail?
Because the main agricultural groups don't want it to happen. It's interesting because they put out a letter, all of the agricultural groups, well, not all of them, but several of them, put out this letter to the House and Senate Agriculture Committee saying, we don't believe that minimum soil erosion standards should apply to crop insurance. The same groups, as part of one of these promotion arms, put out a press release that same day championing their sustainability efforts. So on one hand, you're saying we don't need to have a minimum erosion standard for crop insurance. On the other hand, you're putting out a press release saying we have got this sustainability thing going on and we're so excited about it, you know?
Just to build on that, I mean, it is kind of fascinating because if it's a Republican-dominated, you know, fiscally conservative group that are the lawmakers that are heading these committees, you know, and I asked the risk management deputy administrator from Risk Management Agency was on a drought tour this summer and stopped through Indiana, and I asked over time because last year at Miami we had that lady from Lords of London, and you know, so insurance is all into climate change and figuring out how much it costs, right? So I said, sir, you know, he told all the farmers at this group, I'm sorry, I'm Rebecca Townsend, but from Nouveau and Indianapolis.
Thank you, and try to ask a question.
I'm trying to understand, are they having the fiscal discussion honestly there that is charting their own data that would show the differences in the environmental changes in the I'm not wording this very well, I'm sorry, but the changes in the environmental challenges and how those costs are playing out for.
Well, the Risk Management Agency, which is the agency at USDA that oversees crop insurance, they did a study on climate change and the effects of crop insurance back in 2009, and it charted and questioned the volatility that you were going to see and the impacts that it's going to have on the actuarial soundness of crop insurance over time and the costs that are going to increase. But you really haven't seen any changes or standards in crop insurance among insurers or anybody else that would demand higher requirements. After, I think, a couple of years, you know, part of the reason for that is crop insurance until this year has been pretty profitable. Even last year, with drought in Texas and heavy flooding in the Midwest, the crop insurance industry overall made about $1 billion. This year, they're going to go into the hole. Well, how many years do they end up going into the hole before they say something's got to change and we want to see some shifts in practices before we insure you? But it's going to take, as long as the insurance industry is profitable, they're not going to make those kind of adjustments. You know.
I just might add, it's not related to crop insurance, but are you familiar with the CEAP program, the Conservation Effects Assessment Program? This is a congressionally mandated research effort. The money, I think, goes through NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, and ARS, including many of the labs that I'm involved with are working on this. And And the basic, I'm not directly related to it, but the basic premise is Congress said we spent all these billions of dollars over the years on conservation programs to fund them. What's the bang for the buck? And so it's largely a simulation modeling effort. You can imagine it's just such a big thing for the whole U.S. But my understanding is that the cropped land portion of that program is complete or nearly complete. And currently there's, and probably for a number of years to come, they're working on the rangeland portion of that, which is much more difficult because management is extensive rather than intensive and applied over very large areas.
Jimmy?
Yeah, I was wondering what climate adaptation would look like for agriculture in terms of what kind of policy changes there might be necessary. And would it be different, say, in this part of the country or the central part versus, say, the southeast where I cover environmental issues for the Courier Journal in Louisville?
Kind of restate the question before you answer it, please.
He was asking what climate adaptation policies would go into place for agriculture. And, of course, when you look at farmers, you're talking over a million different small independent businesses, and they change in different ways. Yesterday, when we went on a feedlot and ranching tour, we went to this feedlot, and I was surprised they were planting triticale under center pivot at this feedlot. Triticale is normally a cover crop. Most often you see it used in the north as a winter cover. They were planting it for forage for their livestock. And because it uses less water and it can grow over the winter, they can harvest it, the cattle like it. So they made an adaptation. Rather than planting corn under that pivot, they decided to switch their practices and start cropping it in the winter and using planting a crop that normally you don't see in this area, which I thought that was fairly interesting, coming off and seeing that these guys were planting triticale for a feedlot. But in USDA right now just recently started rolling out a soil health campaign through the Natural Resources Conservation Services. And it focuses on emphasizing no-till, and not just any time, but pure keeping a no-till farming practices, and also putting in cover crops. The cover crops have multiple functions. They put carbon into the soil. They also hold the nutrients better. They will suck up the nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus rather than those leaching through the soil and ending up more into the streams. Much like you see right now in Maryland, where Maryland has a big cover crop, statewide cover crop program. They plant about 650,000 acres of cover crops in Maryland, which I think is probably the biggest state that I have found in terms of planting cover crops. They do that mainly because of the Chesapeake Bay TMDL to avoid nitrogen phosphorus runoff. But there are multiple benefits from that. Those practices of putting a shield, so to speak, on the soil are going to be much more important in the future, because it's not just the fact of protecting the soil from erosion, but ensuring that you're building some organic matter to produce more on that land as our population increases, as we have to intensify production on the land. It's not just the fact that we have the land needs to produce, but we continue to lose it. We have about 28 million acres in the Conservation Reserve Program. We have lost about 28 million acres to development since the mid-80s. So, you know, we continue to lose a great deal of farmland. Where I live, it's just disgusting sometimes to see a subdivision going into an area that, you know, that land was farmed forever and a day, and now you're going to have 15 houses there and a cul-de-sac, you know. Which is just a shame.
A quick follow-up. We heard this morning that GMO crops that would be designed for either heat tolerance or drought tolerance are likely to be needed, or we might see that. Is that, do you think that's...
Well, one of my colleagues is doing some pieces just this week on heat drought-tolerance crops. It was interesting that one of the major companies was growing a drought-tolerant crop. They had to irrigate it to get it to kick it off, though, you know, which kind of an indication it needed water to go off. But what does that mean when it's a drought-tolerant crop? Is that crop going to suck up moisture and nutrients that won't be left behind for the next crop? What is the tolerance of that drought level? Is it going to have a deeper root system? It's somewhat vague at this point on these individual crops of what exactly drought tolerance is going to do and what it's going to do to the soil to continue to grow. And I don't know if Wayne, if you have any focus or interest or work on in that area of drought tolerance.
I don't directly, but you know, if it could just add to your point about what can the government do, since you have a good question.
I think the sentiment that Chris has voiced is that government programs often are a perverse incentive. I know they are on some rangelands because, you know, they encourage not planning for drought. You get the money. You could argue that occurs a lot in government across the board, but I won't go there. I really think things are already happening on rangelands. The producers are making the changes. In South Texas, for example, there's been a shift from the traditional English-based breeds of European-based breeds of cattle, which are not very heat tolerant, to the Indian and Asian breeds, like the Brahmins. You know, so that is occurring. And there's a huge social. It's not just the ecological question of how warming is affecting productivity, potential productivity. Again, as Chris just pointed out, the development, there's a social, economic, political, as well as environmental, and it's all tied together, and that's very, very difficult to get a handle on. And one size never fits all, but one size government policy, in my opinion, will not do the job. I think encouraging good behavior, keeping the soil and the land, increasing monitoring efforts, which are required for adaptive management. Adaptive management means the producers, you know, they desire to have something, they do what they think, put a management in place they think will accomplish that, and then they learn from that. Either it did or it didn't. But learning requires monitoring data, and that's one place the programs could help fund that.
I just wanted to add, there's also talk of adaptation on the forests, which to my knowledge isn't happening in the United States yet, but it's a kind of a debate going on in the scientific community and in the Forest Service about whether to start planting trees in one area that used to grow somewhere else, either farther south or they used to grow farther down the hill. And I don't think the talk so far is so much about going to a new species, but even within a species, there's a seed zone, you know, for a ponderosa pine that grows in Montana versus one that grows in New Mexico, where you might expect the seeds coming from that tree to do better under certain conditions. So the question is whether to start planting trees from New Mexico farther north. And they are doing this, at least in terms of elevation, in British Columbia already, and they're starting to plant trees farther up the hill that used to be growing down here.
Oh, go ahead.
Rich Massey, freelance journalist. About the pine bark beetle infestation, the larger question, what to do about the dead trees, and was there some discussion a few years about biochar possibility?
About
biochar?
Biochar.
Just bioenergy? Is that?
It could be bioenergy, but you know, produced it through, was it pyrolysis? I thought there was a little bit of a movement in Colorado to reduce the trees to biochar, a little bit of investigation.
I think
it bouch or is it burnt, produced charcoal essentially, and that's rich in carbon?
Yeah.
And
okay.
Sequestered carbon.
Yeah, there's.
What do you do with biomass?
There's definitely talk, and Colorado is where I heard the most of it, about making some kind of energy out of the dead trees. To me, it didn't seem like anyone has really gotten to the point where it makes economic sense. I mean, there's some discussion. Like, for instance, in Utah, there's a power plant, a coal-burning power plant sends all of its electricity, basically, almost all of it, to California. And California has these rules where you have to get so much from renewable. So in a case like that, it starts to make sense, and they start to talk about maybe we'll use some wood product in there along with the coal. Right? That hasn't happened yet. And last year when I was in Colorado, there was a plant under construction, but that's as much as I know about it. It seems like it's being discussed everywhere. The University of Montana was trying to start a wood burning, some form of wood energy on campus there to power the campus. But I'm not familiar with a lot of places where it's actually been happening yet.
I just have a pine field question. I know when I used to go to Quebec a lot, and fairly recently there's a fear that the pine needles will go over the Rockies or go up through Canada and then down. Mm-hmm. Where does that lie now? I don't know the state.
I was in Alberta 2 or 3 weeks ago working on that, and it's very real. Apparently, I couldn't find anyone there who doesn't believe it will happen. So the beetles now, when I was saying that they had jumped the Rockies and gone into Alberta, that happened in 2006, I think. The big flood. There was this big outbreak in Prince George, British Columbia, and it just happened that there was this thunderstorm and wind that swept all these beetles at the right time. There's like a 2 week period where they fly, and there was just massive wind that moved them a couple hundred miles into Alberta, and they kind of sprinkled onto the boreal forest around Slave Lake, Alberta, and they've just been persisting since, and had another flight in 2009. And so the question was, can they get into jackpine, which is what you'll run into there, and head toward the east, or is there something about jackpine that they won't like compared to lodgepole? And now they've determined that they're eating the jackpine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was last year. This is the University of Alberta proved that. So now, I couldn't find anyone to say it's not going to happen. The question is it going to happen like that, where there's this big flight and it goes hundreds of miles, or will it be 20 years from now? 20 years seemed to be a popular number from people I talked to. But
and just a follow-up question for the conifers of like the east, or have there been a lot of tests on to see? I mean, jack pines like Quebec, and you know what I mean? As far as the northeast U.S. and going into, you know, Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, have there been a lot of tests on the pine beetles will attack those trees?
The jack pine?
No, I know the jack pine.
Oh. No, I don't. I'm not aware of anyone having put beetles on one of those species back there. I mean, I do know that in Wisconsin, they have jack pine, and they've done some research on how well those, on the chemistry of those trees. And there's something about jack pine that apparently is not only not so good at fighting the beetle, but helps the beetle, because the beetle needs a pheromone to send out and to other beetles and say, hey, let's attack this tree together. And something about the chemistry of the jack pine creates more of that. So I don't know about the other species. I guess you'd be like, what, into eastern white pine?
Yes, or,
well, it's not going to likely get into those. But whatever pine species you have there, so far out west, it doesn't seem to care what the pine is. It gets into it, you know. But I don't know about the east.
Like small goats.
I feel like listening to Brandon that they're going to take all the trees and put them in a tree museum. You know? That just seems to come to my head that, you know, one day the trees will be in a museum, you know.
Well, we've got time for another question. Does anyone have one?
Yeah. Question, I guess, for Brandon about the...
Could you, I'm sorry, could you
oh, my name is Dave Minkin. I'm with the National Parks Conservation Association in Salt Lake City. And I have a question about the potential for intense wildfire with pine beetle killed trees throughout the West. What's the evidence of that? What's the potential for that? It gets to the question earlier about how to deal with dead trees.
It's a really complicated question and one that I think is still being answered. But the conventional wisdom for years was that pine beetle killed trees will light up and burn really intensely, and you're going to have terrible forest fires because of it. And it makes sense because that those needles get dried. You don't have the moisture in the trees anymore. It's going to be dry, a nice fuel, but a lot of the science that's been happening lately, and the modeling, I should say it's modeling, based on fuel loads, suggests that after a few years when all those needles fall off, it's actually less likely to burn it at such an intense rate and get into a crown fire than before when the tree was alive. During those first few years, it would seem that if you have a lightning strike at that time or something else to start a fire, it's pretty dangerous. After that, maybe the risk is going to decrease for some time, and then after that, the trees are going to start falling up and stacking on top of each other, and then you have a whole different situation, which might be dangerous, but that's decades out because, I was just in Yellowstone, and from those 88 fires, some of those trees are still standing. They have a tendency to just stay there for a long time. But
can I add to that? I've done several stories about this for the Colorado, and specifically in relation to the Hyde Park fire this year. And a number of studies that the Roger Dunn Research Station and CSU have done have basically shown that the influence of bark beetle killed trees on how fires burn and how intensely they burn are the influence is negligible, apparently. Now, if you talk to firefighters, they'll tell you something different. They'll tell you that bark beetle killed trees explode like nothing you've ever seen. I'm not sure who to believe, and there's conflicting information within the U.S. Forest Service and within the Colorado State Forest Service. I asked Tom Vilsack this question about 3 weeks ago in Denver, and he didn't have an answer. But the scientists I talked to have said, look at Yellowstone fire of 1988, the 2002 fire in Colorado, the name just escaped me. Neither of these fires had any beetle kill in them whatsoever, and they burned very intensely. There's some science that suggests that the oils in the pine needles might actually make the oils in the pine needles make it, increase the flammability slightly, especially when they're drought stricken. But the one thing that correlates along across all of these massive wildfires is drought. At least that's what I've
heard. Yeah, we had the big fires this year, and Colorado probably had it worse than we did. But Dave, you live in Salt Lake, you probably ski, you know what kind of winter we had. So, there was a clear weather connection to what happened this year.
I just want to note that we've pulled together a few resources, collectively the panel, that I didn't get together and format in time to print out for everybody, but if you're interested in receiving this Word document with these links, I've just got a sign-up sheet here, so if you just put your name and your email address, and I'll send them out to you. And thanks very much to our speakers. Really appreciate it.